This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Hello and good morning. Welcome to The Morning Run on BFM 89.9, the business station. I'm Melissa Idris. I've got Julian Ng and Sharad Kutin here with me to keep you company for the next 4 hours with Ibrahim Sani. He'll join us shortly.
Oh, good morning.
Good morning.
I'm people. So excited. It's a Friday.
It's a Friday, yeah.
We go through this ritual every week where we celebrate the
that's
Fridayness
life.
Of things.
And there's something about the week. Friday always comes just before the weekend. It's, you know, it's shocking but true.
That I never realized that.
That's profound, Sharon. That's deep.
Thank you for telling me.
Well, good morning to all. 6 o'clock now, Friday the 27th of May. It's lots of things happening around the world, of course, but we will keep you abreast of any major developments. You know, you've got the G7 happening in Japan. Lots of comments coming up from there. But locally at home as well, we've got lots of developments on the political front. Let's just discuss that in a few minutes. But first, let me tell you what's coming up on The Breakfast Grill. I will be speaking to a fintech company, a Sharia-compliant real estate crowdfunding platform. They claim to be the world's first to do so. Umar Munshi is the founder of EthisCrowd.com, and I'll be speaking to him about the business proposition of EthisCrowd, which they have an affordable housing project, several, in fact, in Indonesia, which is an interesting market to be in because, you know, it's huge and there's lots of potential there, but also many challenges. You've got, you know, the red tape, the allegations of a huge systemic corruption there as well. So some things to discuss with him.
And a lot of people who will demand those kind of affordable housing. Interesting that this company has 3 degrees of specialization: ethical, Sharia, and real estate. And perhaps crowdfunding if you want to throw that into the mix. So they're like mixing all the you know, latest trends together.
Yeah.
They're very fashionable. I think about Indonesia is, you know, over the years they've had some scandals with regard to things like halal certification. There was a big scandal around that. Basically, you know, those involved in halal certification wanting kickbacks from, you know, Australian companies and, you know, going on these trips and such. And all exposed by a very vigilant and robust media in Indonesia. Asia.
Yeah.
So, you know, if you go to magazines like Tempo, broke some of these big stories.
Mm-hmm. Well, so I think it's interesting because, you know, you're talking about the many layers, right? So ethical in a sense that they want to be socially responsible, so they do affordable housing projects. Sharia compliant in terms of financially, how they deal with their finances. So, you know, it's a double layer like you mentioned, Julian.
But yeah. So is the Sharia compliant now just about finding a...
It's like a quiz show. You press the buzzer
before the question.
Yeah. So wait, let me just preempt you. You're asking you whether it's just solely financial? Was that what
you
wanted to ask?
No, you see, that was not the question.
Minus 1 point.
It's about finding new markets. Like, basically, Sharia compliance is the, you know, the construction of a new market segment that might have not been there. It's not a natural segment. It's about what people now desire from, you know, financial instruments or services and goods, right? I mean, because with goods and services, halal has been there for some time, but with maybe a different order of services and goods, this is unusual, right?
Perhaps not quite a new market segment.
Who would imagine there would be Sharia-compliant airlines? And, you know, who would even understand what that meant, you know,
but what
only
does,
5 years ago?
What does Sharia-compliant real estate mean? Isn't real estate naturally Sharia compliant?
Yes. So that's, I think, one angle that I would be discussing with him because of the tangible asset backing the transaction. I also think that there's a whole other issue. So I wonder whether he's, and when I say he, I mean Umar Munshi, the founder of CrowdEthis, whether there is a differentiation between ethical and Sharia compliant and all the layers that come in between, because he seems to find, I think there's a difference between his perception of Islamic banking and Sharia compliant crowdfunding, perhaps. So lots of things to discuss with
him. You know, the question you might ask him is, why isn't it low carbon footprint as well? And I think that's something that is also very fashionable, right? I mean, these terms are, or so-called principles or, you know, validations are, you know, appended to a whole range of goods and services as well. You know, so, you know, eco-friendly, low carbon footprint.
Which you have to then also find out whether that piece of land on which you are building the homes, whether that was obtained through corrupt means, for instance.
Yeah, to make sure that, you know, that every part of the process is transparent and ethical. Okay, well, let's start the breakfast grill. Umar Munshi, the co-founder of ethicscrowd.com. And we, as we mentioned earlier, developments on the local political front, we've got Pakatan Harapan saying that they will announce their candidate for the Sungai Besar by-election seat by the 1st of June, so next Wednesday, right?
Yeah, by next Wednesday, or I read it as Monday, actually. But the what is interesting is that this announcement was made by Wan Azizah, who heads PKR, and Azmin Ali, who's been trying to negotiate a deal, an electoral deal with a PAS, and a PAC that would have PAS take Kuala Kangsar and Pakatan take Sungai Besar, failed. And he was not at this announcement. So there's also a question of, you know, factionalism and factional fighting in PKR at this point in time, or differences of strategy between the Menteri Besar of Selangor and the leaders of Pakatan at a national level. So I think that's really... and the other question, of course, that's going to be asked is, who will they put up? Will they put up a candidate from PKR, or will they put up a candidate from AMANA? AMANA, of course, being the splinter group, which said that if PAS goes into this, they will, in fact, not hold back and put themselves, you know, in the front. And we're going to be talking more about this, you know, at 8:30, trying to get a sense of the different scenarios that arise from this. All kinds of interesting dynamics. Yeah.
How are the odds stacked, though, as to who will win?
Depends on who's going to be nominated, who's going to be the candidate.
Well, so, yeah, there's that. I think Wong Chin-Wat, who we're talking to at 8:30, has already written a piece about this. Both seats, Kuala Kangsar and Sungai Besar, were won with a very thin margin. In terms of numbers, Sungai Besar was only 399 votes in favour of the Barisan National candidate from UMNO. Kuala Kangsar was slightly larger, it was 1,000 votes, but in percentage terms, you know, it was tiny, right? So one in the low 50s, the winner in the low 50s, and the loser in the high 40s.
Okay, so everyone has a good stab on this, but there is some amount of infighting that's coming out of PKR at this point in time.
Yeah, but so with UMNO, right? So you have Dr. Mahathir, this was not true in 2013 at the general elections. Dr. Mahathir is now on a campaign to unseat the Prime Minister. The Prime Minister, since 2013, has been embroiled in the 1MDB controversy. He sacked his Deputy Prime Minister. Both the ex-Deputy Prime Minister, Tan Sri Muhyiddin Yassin, and Mukhris Mohamad, who was the former Menteri Besar of Kedah and son of Tun Mahathir, are both on the margins now. In fact, there have been calls for them either to be sacked or for them to prove their loyalty to UMNO by, you know, by supporting UMNO in this campaign. So a lot of questions even on the UMNO side of it. The question is, and the question we're going to put to Chin-Wat is, has the ground shifted for all these parties, for all the stakeholders in this game?
Well, you know, there was also news that Rafizi Ramli said he was going to lodge a report of the Selangor government corruption allegations on Monday. So I think that could be an example of, you know, again, the bickering in the party, if there are truly rifts in each of the coalitions.
Absolutely. You know, and maybe, Melissa, I got that wrong. I got my Rafizi Ramli story with my Pakatan announcement.
So Pakatan announcement on Wednesday, the announcement for candidates or nominations on Wednesday, with Rafizi to lodge a report on Monday.
Monday, right. So, and in fact, today we're going to be interviewing Rafizi Ramli on what the agenda is in this allegations of corruption in the Selangor government. How high up does it go, you know, in the food chain, as it were? And you'll be able to see that interview on BFM Uncensored. That's our video program, and that's going to be coming out later today. So catch that.
Interesting, for sure. There's also other developments in Parliament. So yesterday, PAS unexpectedly asked Parliament not to debate its private members' bill on Hudud. In fact, they asked to defer it to the next parliamentary meeting. So what happened was Speaker Tan Sri Pandika Amin Mulia had approved Dato' Sri Azlina Osman's motion to elevate the private member's bill in the tabling order. It was initially set to be the 15th and final item in the order papers, but by approving it, the Speaker pushed the next order of item after the government's bill.
This, of course, is one unexpected move after another unexpected move.
Yeah.
It was unexpected that a private member's bill, no reason why a private member's bill even gets to be debated. So it has to have and often have the support of a minister or the ruling government.
What is a private member's bill?
So this is brought not by members of parliament. Right, and so it doesn't come from government, and it doesn't have
government or MPs.
So the government of the day, which is the Barisan National Government, can propose the list of bills to be. This has got to do with those who are not so not from the executive branch. It's coming from the legislature. Right? So that's the difference, right? So the government of the day is the Barisan National Government represented by its cabinet ministers in parliament, but it's the executive branch putting up the list of bills to be discussed. Private members' bills are those not coming from the executive branch.
Okay, so if you're an MP, you can, and not necessarily a cabinet minister, you can bring up a private,
yes,
private
members'
bill.
Yes, you can, but it doesn't necessarily have to be debated. So
This was really low in the order.
Private members' bills always come after the bills that are put forward by the executive and don't necessarily get debated. In fact, the last time, you know, because this private member's bill that passed and Hadi has put forward has been there for some time. It's been passed over.
Well, it was April and June of last year.
Yeah,
so
and they've
times.
Been very upset about it. So in an unexpected move, UMNO supported a passed private member bill and an unexpected reaction to that, PAS said
to defer
it to the next session.
Okay.
Right? But it does show...
Confusing.
It does show a signal, again, very strong signal about the cooperation between PAS and UMNO at this point in time. Right? The question, of course, is what is the game being played? Did PAS not know that this private member's bill was going to be forwarded and then was caught off guard? Or did they know?
Yeah.
But, in fact, just wanted to demonstrate of the close cooperation and the fact that UMNO supports the PAS agenda in Kelantan.
This is so House of Cards, man.
Well, you know, there's that. But there's also this really... So I think a lot of people are unsure about what this is. It isn't that Hadi's bringing a bill to push for hudud for Malaysia. The bill has to do with the statutory limits on punishments that can be meted out by Sharia courts. Right, so we have had for decades now an enactment in Kelantan that could not be put into practice because it would have clashed with the statutory limits now imposed. What they're asking for is an amendment to the Federal Level Act that would then free up the state of Kelantan. So you raise the bar on punishment that will allow the enactment in Kelantan that's been on the books for decades to go through.
So what are some of these punishments?
Oh, okay. I have a list here, but I think it's... let me just see. Sharia courts are currently authorized to issue sentences limited to $5,000 in fines and 3 years in jail and 6 strokes of caning. So that's the maximum that a Sharia court can issue. But now the proposed amendment to the Sharia Court Act amendment is to empower them to mete out higher penalties necessary to implement hudud.
Yeah, so hudud would call for the amputation of limbs and such, right? So that's one of the things on the books. What's very interesting is the Deputy Prime Minister came out saying, well, this only is about Kelantan. Because I think critics will argue with him that that's not true. It opens the floodgates for any other state assembly to push similar legislation as Kelantan has put on its books, right? So we could have other states where there's a tremendous pressure from PAS or that constituency to push through hudud in other states. So I think Zaid Hamidi is wrong in saying that this is a question limited only to Kelantan.
Okay, we'll be discussing this further in about an hour or so. But right now, it's 6:15. We'll be back with more in just a minute. BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, Steve Harley there with Make Me Smile. Good morning, I'm Melissa Idris. I've got Sharad Kutan and Julian Ng here with me, 6:20 on the clock. Now, some quick finish up of the news roundup we had a little earlier. The incoming president of the Philippines, Rodrigo Duterte, yesterday he asserted that his administration is staking a fresh claim on Sabah. So there were several Philippine dailies that reported Duterte saying his administration recognizes Sabah as a Sulu Sultanate, which is being claimed by the Kiram clan. So Duterte says they will assert the claim of the Sulu Sultanate, whose leaders are citizens of the Philippines.
Well, you know, Duterte had already made this comment and supportive of the Kiram family even before
during the campaign,
right? It said that his mother is, in fact, a Moro, though he himself is Christian. And what's really interesting, because he comes from the South, that these players, I mean, in Malaysia, we often see them as, you know, outlaws because of what happened at Lahad Datu. But actually, they're not. They are stakeholders in the politics of Southern Philippines. And so, you know, this might be a gesture. We don't know if it will actually translate into actual policy. Remember, last year, we interviewed the ambassador of the Philippines, and I asked him this question, because mm-hmm. Aquino also, in a long interview, once when asked about Sabah, and the interview was about all kinds of things, he said, yes, we haven't given up the claim. And when I pressed the ambassador, he says, oh, we're not that serious about it. So, you know, this claim has been there. The question is, Duterte is just saying he's not taking it off the books, but will they actually do things
anything
that are material that will affect relationship between the Philippines and Malaysia?
I think we have to deal with the other big in the room, which is China's claim on the South China Sea. I think that's a much bigger one, and that will just overpower the other claims.
Duterte, of course, is saying that you know, he wants better relations with China. The Philippines calls it the West Philippine Sea, by the way. But China's claims do not hit land, right? So it comes up to 80 kilometers out off the coast of Miri, and that's where the 9-dash line is. And that was China draws it. But these are maritime boundaries, unlike the claims on Sabah, which have to do with territory as well.
I don't know if the differences are just academic, you know, because there's a lot of economic and monetary gains from the South China Sea. A lot of oil is in there. And if you claim land such as Sabah, you get some timber, you get more land, yeah. I guess. And it comes with some sea territories as well, I guess.
Yeah, but, it, you know, there's been already arbitration on this question. I don't know how strong the Philippine claim is based on a range of things. But again, it's on the books because the political realities.
So in a nutshell, this is probably him resurfacing the issue, but perhaps not something, not an indication of material action, perhaps, for now. Is that how we can read this? All right. Well, in around other news around the world, Donald Trump has surpassed the number of delegates needed to clinch the GOP nomination. So he has received confirmation of new unbound delegates in North Dakota, Colorado, and Pennsylvania. So now the delegate count shows that Trump has earned one more than the 1,237 he needed for a nomination. But it's not official yet, though, mm-hmm. until July.
I don't think this will come as any surprise to anybody because he's been just running so strong in the Republican primaries. But what I think that figures like Donald Trump and Bernie Sanders have achieved is how they are going to change the narrative and the dialogue for primaries, attacking the integrity of the primaries themselves, as Bernie Sanders especially saying that the voting system is unfair, and also changing the conversation within those two parties, both the Democratic and the Republican, talking more about what's closer to the hearts of the people.
Yeah, the Bernie Sanders campaign, the extent I understand it, in California, says to people, the message is, this is a vote about how the direction that the political party takes, right? It's not about getting Bernie Sanders as the nominee. It's about the direction of the party. So they're looking for, even as Hillary kind of all but clinches the nomination, a strong message from California will mean, because I think they're running neck and neck, aren't they? Strong message to her and the convention that people who support the Democratic Party want an agenda more reflective of their own rather than of the party elders or Wall Street.
Well, they're not running neck and neck if you include the superdelegates, but if you just have pledged delegates, then it's pretty close, although Clinton still has a pretty big margin. And that's why Sanders is complaining about the unfairness of the superdelegate system where the delegates can do what they want.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. What I meant was they're running neck to neck in the Californian primaries.
Well, speaking of political leadership in the US, Barack Obama, you know, he's on this Asia tour leading up to the G7 meeting in Japan. So he was in Vietnam earlier this week. And there were reports that he had stopped for a meal with Anthony Bourdain, the celebrity chef of Parts Unknown. And the photos that came out of it led to some speculation as to how impromptu this this little soiree was.
I don't know. I don't like this, although I think that President Obama is a very savvy, media savvy and social media savvy, pop culture kind of president. You know, he appears on talk shows and he's very funny and he's very witty and a lot of people like to watch what he does. But the real thing is, whether he has fulfilled his electoral promises. And I think that the jury is still very much out on that.
Okay, so let's tweet out this link, Sharad, from the BBC, where they've got several photos of that meal that Obama shared with Anthony Bourdain. And the BBC has listed six things about this that look suspicious.
Yeah. Well, you know, he arrived in Hanoi on the 22nd of May, just to get the dates
okay,
on this.
Okay, thank you.
I'm going to tweet this out. I wonder if this has to do with the post-presidential life of Obama. I hope he doesn't get into cooking shows because I don't think he's, and I don't know, of course, whether he demonstrates any talent in the kitchen, apart from his kitchen cabinet. Ha ha. So the question
so
is
bad.
Whether...
That
I know,
was
it's, it was, but it's, you know, it's 6:27 in the morning. I think we allowed some lame jokes. The question, of course, is celebrity culture, right? And politicians glumming themselves to celebrities and vice versa. There seems to be some sort of, love affair.
I think the bigger question to that is whether you're using your celebrity status to really hide the true facts. Like, is there a critical assessment of whether what you have done is really right?
So,
and people accord the success of his presidency to, let's say, the achievement of Obamacare.
No, hold on. These two C words do not come together. They live on different planets.
What two
celebrity
C words?
And criticality. Two, you know,
that, okay. That's what I'm saying. I mean, they're at opposite ends.
Can we look at this on the other side? Benefit of doubt. So he's a president who's about to see his term end and he's not going to run again, or he cannot run again. He's now just doing what he wants. He wants to have a meal with Anthony Bourdain at a street food vendor in Vietnam. Is that such a big deal?
And it could never have been so spontaneous. I mean, do you think it was spontaneous?
That's the contention with the BBC saying that according to some of the photos, nobody appears to know where they are. So there's a photo of Obama sitting with Anthony Bourdain there, and all the other people in the room don't seem to be aware that Obama is sitting in the at the table next to them.
So would you
like a leader or a president who is very savvy and very entertaining to watch on social media, but who has not, and you have not really questioned what he has really achieved for you, right? President Obama, is he such a president? That's the question. Because if you look at the scale of left to right of economic policies, actually, Obama is to the right of even Hillary Clinton, right? Obviously, take healthcare, for example. I mean, his biggest achievement is Obamacare. He's actually, according to some analysis, to even more moderate than, let alone Bernie Sanders, who's off the charts for healthcare and education. But Obama is to the right of Hillary Clinton and Bill Clinton, as far as healthcare is concerned.
I don't see how this... outing of his, you know, whatever being social media savvy he is, has anything to do with his presidential legacy, though? I mean, Obamacare and his whatever he's done for the U.S. economy and jobs is one thing, but, you know, him having a social media persona is different.
I think it's got mildly something to do with corruption, right? If you were a dictator for 20 years and you have a daughter who is active in a social, what do you call it, in NGOs, right?
Social
activism, and you cast a pallor of benignness about yourself, right? Does it forgive the misdeeds
what
of the father,
before.
Right? It's the same thing. If you not achieve what you want set out to achieve, but you're very well loved by the media for no apparent reason, is that a good thing for the country?
Well, you know, the question at the end of the day is how people are going to assess him, right? So you're going to have all these critical assessments that might gather dust, and all that will be left is, you know, the last impression people had of the man in office, whether it was a friendly meal, with Anthony Bourdain, or it's, you know, patting the dog on the head.
I agree with you, and that's the problem too.
But that's the problem it's a problem of people's attention, right?
Okay, 6:30 now, we've got the news bulletin up next on BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9. Good morning. You just heard George Thorogood there with Treat Her Right. 6:40 right now. I'm Melissa Idris with Sharad Kutan and Julian Ng this morning. Now, around the world, traffic accidents kill 1.25 million people per year. But there's an article by City Metric writer James O'Malley, and he writes of an interesting correlation between the number of traffic fatalities in a country and the corruptness of its government. So the title of the article is Bad Drivers Are a Good Indicator of a Corrupt Government. It's a bit of a, I don't know, does it sound like a tenuous link to you, or do you see the correlation there?
I absolutely see the correlation, because when you want something like standards, it costs money, and usually the people who build roads and infrastructure, they want to save costs and they want to profit maximize. So if you are able to, line the pockets, butter up to somebody's palms, you get that laxness and that compromise in standards that lead to bad driving, that leads to accidents on the road. I think it's truly a real reflection of it.
Well, the article goes on to say, well, because it is a contentious type of link that's being made, that the thing that cannot be argued against is that there's a link between corruption and driving in terms of income.
Mm-hmm.
So the more affluent a country is, the more likely it is to have fatalities associated with driving. So I think that's just one part of it. But it's a complex thing. And I think some of it's got to do with culture as well.
Okay, so you've got the infrastructure part that you mentioned, Jules. And the other one is the relationship to income, which you mentioned, Sharad. But there's also another part. Right at the end of the article, the conclusion seems this article seems to draw is that if you're in a country where everyone drives on the sidewalk and nobody stops at stop signs, you can be pretty sure that the government isn't working right. So this is about bending the rules when you should be following.
Right. And I think the perception is, and when we use the expression bending rules, is that we're not breaking rules. We're just bending them to the moment, for the situation, that somehow it's a misdemeanor. It's nothing that serious. And so we tell ourselves that we're not doing anything wrong. And that is where, that's the first stage, as it were, towards, corrupt practices. Because, I remember the dark days in Malaysia when, people thought it was okay to, slip a dollar or two here in order to expedite a process.
Dark days. I mean, I think it's still happening. The other thing about this bending the rules is that I think it's education, right? And education is a very long-term thing. If your governance in a country is bad, you tend to cut corners in very important areas like education, healthcare, housing and all that have all contributing factors to why the citizens of the country react a certain way. Like they don't have the time to stop for people to cross the road, for example, and that makes you a very bad driver. I was in Bangkok, as you were, Sharad, 2 weeks ago, And I was surprised, even shocked, to find that maybe perhaps 5 or 6 times as I was about to cross the road, the cars over there stopped for me. So is that bad driving? And is Thailand a corrupt government, a corrupt country, right? In Malaysia, that never, almost never happens.
Okay, so
they would run you down.
Yeah, you got to make sure that you watch out for the cars, even
it's defensive
on a,
walking in this country.
Even on a zebra crossing.
You know, Ezra Zayed of the Evening Edition once told me this really, a funny anecdote that's really stayed with me. So he said that when he first started driving, he was driving around with his grandfather in the car, and it was late at night. There were no cars on the road, and it was a red light. So they stopped at a red light, and he had, I think, tried to move forward, if I'm not mistaken, and run this red light. And his grandfather told him that the mark of a civilized society is what you do with the rules when no one is looking. Do you follow the rules or do you break the rules when no one is looking and you're not worried about getting caught? And when I remember he was telling this story, and it really stayed with me, because now every time I'm at a red light, Ezra's grandfather's voice is in my head, even though I've never spoken to the man.
That's the acid test, I think.
Yeah. So the two concepts that come out of this these two articles, one is bending rules and stretching the truth, or truth stretching. So again, you're not telling a lie. You're merely massaging the truth, or as you see it, to encompass what you're doing, right? So
otherwise known as struthing, right?
Struthing, is that what it is? And I wonder about this tax avoidance, tax evasion business.
Uh-huh. Absolutely.
Because that's a kind of a fine line. I mean, there might be legal definitions between that, but I'm wondering about the ethics of a tax avoidance, especially because what are you avoiding but your contributions to larger society? You're trying to avoid or trying to reduce your contributions to wider society, and is that ethical, especially for the super rich, where the question of tax avoidance really is a real question, unlike many of us where tax avoidance isn't really a question because we're not earning enough for tax avoidance to even kick in.
Is there a difference between a lie and a fib and stretching the truth? I mean, is that just shades of grey?
I think if it involves lives, you have to be pretty serious about it. I mean, if you build infrastructure poorly, if you drive badly and kill people, if you run away from taxes, depending on the quantum of that tax evasion, if you're talking about billions of dollars, there must be some kind of shaming of what you're doing, right? If you're running away with billions of dollars of taxes, I mean, I don't think that's right. And furthermore, you make it seem you're basically telling other people that this is okay. I'm doing it. You can do it too. And it's a very pervasive thing in society.
Well, you know, let's still keep on to that traffic rules example, right? Is there such a thing as justified rule breaking when it comes to perhaps something like traffic rules, because we're talking about traffic accidents? So I've spoken to people before who have run red lights, say late at night or early mornings, and they say, well, you know, I'm driving in the car alone and I'm a single female driver. I'm concerned that it's more dangerous to be sitting at a red light all alone at night. So again, that's their justification for it. So
if you think about it, you know, Malaysian traffic lights are spoiled all the time, right? And not all the time, but sometimes you're forced to just be careful as you are driving, crossing the junction without the help of traffic lights. And that happens early in the morning as well. You can be actually extremely careful about it and not harm anybody. But that is a form of bending the rules, I guess.
Yeah. Steve has tweeted and he says, bad drivers are usually unqualified to be on the roads. Guess how they got their licenses in the first place, right?
So he's alluding to
the lesen terbang or the
duit kopi. Mm-hmm.
Right. So a lot of people, and I often, that's my, you know, comment usually when I'm angry with somebody who's just done something really silly on the road, is so where did they get their license from? So immediately you think that the person is badly trained,
okay,
and that schools have allowed this person to go through because driving schools are essentially money-making machines for the owners and and for many of the operators in that system, right? They don't really care about the quality of drivers that are going up. They just care about whether they can get as much money from the people who come to sit for those classes.
So this all goes back to our attitudes and our culture and the kind of long-term training, whether real or psychological, that that's been imparted and ingrained into us, right? And driving is only one of those reflections. What about smoking in public? I mean, don't talk about having a more progressive government if you can't be conscionable about your smoking. I mean, smoking in restaurants, it's just like killing other people, right? A secondhand.
Well, I don't think it's killing people. I mean, that's an.
I don't know how you can take a laissez-faire view about this. I mean, the dangers of secondhand smoking is clear.
I think the issue here, of course, is, you know, degrees. It's not like killing, because killing is a direct act. You can talk about pollutants in the air caused by industry and agriculture. They're killing us too. I mean, everything we do in life, it seems to be
killing us. No, but this is a conscious act that you take to, while you're sitting on a table besides a non-smoker, to start smoking. And I think it's dangerous. It's plain and simple dangerous, right? What about smoking at entrances of building? When you do that, you can't be at the same time talking about changing a corrupt government because you're smoking in front of a building.
Well, tell us what you think. I mean, do you agree with the premise of this article that we're talking about, that bad drivers are a good indicator of a corrupt government, if rule bending is also an indicator of corruption, right?
Yeah, and truth stretching. That's
truth stretching.
That's true. So there are two things you're going to be using in your speech today is rule bending and struthing. See if anybody even recognizes what you're saying or understands what you're saying.
At BFM Radio is our handle. 0162019000 is the number to text. We've got news coming up at the top of the hour. Stay tuned. BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.